It's Tuesday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, election recounts in several states raises animosity between the U.S. presidential campaigns.
This vote might eventually count, and this vote might eventually change things, or at least this vote may eventually shake power.
Europeans take closer looks at conservative candidates following Trump's win. Also ahead, control of Aleppo continues, financial markets pause near record levels, and a dark day in recent U.S. history marked on film. It's all in today's International Edition. The White House, major U.S. media outlets, and fact-checkers are debunking President-elect Donald Trump's claim that millions of people voted illegally in the November 8th election that he won. In Twitter posts Sunday, the Republican Trump claimed he would have defeated Democrat Hillary Clinton in a nationwide popular vote if you deduct, quote, the millions of people who voted illegally, end quote. Later, he called into question the results in three states he lost to Clinton without offering any evidence. But White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Monday there has been no evidence produced to substantiate Trump's claims. Election experts say there is scant evidence of vote fraud in U.S. elections. By winning numerous states by relatively narrow margins, Trump won the presidency in the Electoral College, 306 to 232, while Clinton, by piling up a huge vote advantage in California and New York, leads the national popular vote. Trump voiced annoyance, rather, in recent days that Clinton, after conceding the election, has joined Green Party nominee Jill Stein in supporting a vote recount in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin. There, Trump defeated Clinton by about 27,000 votes. Stein received about 1% of the vote. Mark Thompson is the Wisconsin Election Commission chairman.
I think it most unfortunate that the president-elect is claiming that there's huge problems with our system, and that's feeding what I call this conspiracy theory. I mean, it's just, you know, I personally, I'd like him to come down out of his Trump Tower and go up to Wautoma and Washira County and spend the time with the folks on the ground that are counting these votes.
Stein's campaign also petitioned Pennsylvania officials Monday to start a recount in that eastern state, where Trump prevailed by about 69,000 votes. Stein, with Clinton's support, could also contest the outcome in Michigan, where Trump won by about 11,000 votes. Commission Chairman Thompson vigorously defended Wisconsin's election system, saying he was certain that the president-elect would emerge as the winner after the recount.
I fully expect, given the history of how elections are conducted in Wisconsin and their accuracy and my trust in my citizens who are counting these votes, that the outcome is not going to be different.
Clinton would have to overturn the outcome in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania to win the presidency in the Electoral College, but her aides have acknowledged that the margin in all three states is greater than has ever been overcome in a presidential recount. In Wisconsin, Mike Haas, the State Election Commission Administrator, says their recount should be quick.
Many of our counties we expect to be finished in a week or a little over a week. But if you talk about Dane County, Milwaukee County, Greene County, Waukesha County, some of our more populous counties, it is going to be a challenge.
A post on Stein's campaign's website called the voting machines used in Wisconsin highly vulnerable to hacking and malicious programming and said the machines lacked any security features. Wisconsin must meet a federal deadline of December 13th to complete its recount. Time for us now to check out what's trending on the web. And for that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, joins me here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
So what's the online reaction to a shooting incident that occurred today at Ohio State University?
So, Jim, most of the Twitter conversation is about the suspect. It's confirmed that the suspect connected to the attack is killed, and this is what we know so far. He was either in his late teens or early 20s, wielding a knife and a Somali refugee. Out of all the three available information, his ethnicity and legal status as a U.S. resident caused the most amount of buzz online.
Okay, that's interesting. Could you give us an example?
Sure. So here's what a senior producer with NBC News tweeted. Police believe suspect was a student at OSU, that stands for Ohio State University, a Somali refugee and lawful permanent resident of the U.S. The top comment to that tweet reads, O Jesus Christ, a Somali immigrant. ISIS, thanks Obama. Others criticized the suspect's Muslim name. But on the brighter side, some people said that it's not fair to criticize the suspect based on his religious beliefs. Here's an example. All because the Ohio State attacker was Muslim still does not give you a right to bash the Muslim faith or those who practice a religion.
Okay, well, let's move on to our next topic. What are people saying about Cyber Monday?
Yeah, so it definitely seems like Black Friday when retailers introduce massive discounts is far too close to Cyber Monday. Mm-hmm. It's only 2 days apart. That's the Monday after Thanksgiving when retailers offer discounts online. Many Twitter and Facebook users are sharing memes of going through a tsunami of emails because this is a day when many American retailers send out promotional emails.
Okay. Do we have anything else trending?
Sure. So, you know it's getting quite cold here in D.C. with the highs being in the 50s. The last trending topic I want to mention is cats lounging on radiators. They're very smart. Cat owners are sharing photos of their felines relaxing on top of radiators. Jim, back to you.
Okay. As we know, some pets are smarter than we are. Thank you so much, G. You can follow our program's account on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm out there at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are currently trending in Asia, opposition leads street protests against India currency ban. South Korean president fades as impeachment looms. Vietnam taking long-term hard line toward China on maritime claims. China detains 9 for cooling tower collapse. Lives on hold. Hazara refugees fight boredom in Indonesia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And take the news with you. Try out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Voters in Europe are increasingly looking at far-right candidates following Donald Trump's presidential victory here in the United States. Henry Ridgewell has the latest.
Norbert Hofer is hoping to ride a global wave of insurgent populism to win the Austrian presidency.
Whenever the elites distance themselves from voters, those elites will be voted out of the office.
Hofer's far-right Freedom Party has warned of a civil war over migration. His extreme rhetoric is winning votes. Polls give him a slim lead over his rival, the Green Party's Alexander van der Bellen.
Politicians are playing with these fears. They are actually offering a new model of identification. And this model of identification is going back to the golden lands, even if they never existed.
Marine Le Pen, the leader of France's far-right National Front, has promised to turn back the clock to the days before the European Union and global free trade.
The British and the Americans dismiss these patronizing campaigns, these campaigns of fear. I'm convinced that the French people can too.
France's two-round election system has so far kept the far right out of power. But 2016 has shown that past voting patterns are a poor guide to modern politics.
Many people are feeling that maybe it's worth voting for these protest movements because this vote might eventually count and this vote might eventually change things, or at least this vote may eventually shake power.
Critics point to a common ally of the far right, Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russian banks gave Marine Le Pen multi-million dollar loans to fight her campaign.
Putin is willing to fund all these far right movements because they can only make pressure in the European Union context. But I think that is also a matter of, in national societies, what they can say about Russia.
That sympathy for Moscow is echoed by the political opposition in Italy, which smells victory in a referendum on constitutional change scheduled December 4th. A no vote could topple Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. In the Netherlands, the far-right Freedom Party tops the polls ahead of 2017 elections, despite the ongoing trial of its leader, Geert Wilders, on charges of inciting racial hatred. For now, all eyes are on Austria, which could deliver the first of a series of electoral earthquakes in Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In the embattled city of Aleppo, state media and a rights group said Monday Russian-backed Syrian allied forces have captured all of the northern neighborhoods of the rebel-held eastern sector, including the vital al-Sakhr district. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that would cut rebel sector in town, and it said about 30% of rebel-controlled land has been lost. Thousands of residents have fled the latest fighting, many going to Kurdish areas, others to the government-held western sector. Analyst David Leish, a history professor at Trinity University in Texas, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Syria and its allies have been pressing their weeks-long offensive, in part bolstered by Russian airstrikes, and because they expected former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to prevail in this month's U.S. election.
Certainly since the airstrikes began recently, Russia and the regime in Damascus were expecting a victory by Hillary Clinton, and that didn't happen. But if it did happen, I think they wanted to rush in and finish the job, so to speak, in Aleppo before a Clinton administration began, one that they feared would be a little bit more assertive in terms of countering the regime and Russian designs in Syria. Now that Donald Trump won the election, and at least according to what he has said, you know, wants to work more with Russia in Syria and even with the Syrian regime, as ISIS is the number one enemy, and to focus U.S. energies in that corridor, the Russians and the Syrian regime feel as though they have almost a carte blanche to do what's necessary in Aleppo. So, you know, in either event, I think they were going to rush in and finish the job in Aleppo. But I think now with Trump election, perhaps they feel, you know, a little bit less pressured to militarily accomplish their goals there.
What happens to the hundreds and thousands of residents who are fleeing?
Well, that's a big question. And one of the reasons that many of them weren't fleeing until now was that they didn't really know what their disposition would be. Would they go into a worse situation? They don't trust the Syrian regime when they offer amnesty and offer safe passage. But now they obviously are compelled to do so because of the military onslaught. And it's just added to the numbers of internally displaced Syrians. Some may obviously try to cross the border into Turkey, which is much harder than it used to be.
Well, David, I think you're familiar with Aleppo. You've been there. Rebel defenses collapsed as government forces pushed into the city's Sakhr neighborhood, coming within 1 kilometer of commanding a corridor in eastern Aleppo for the first time since rebels first swept into the city back in 2012.
It certainly could be considered, as of now, something of a victory for the regime. Whether or not they'll be able to finish off the job, one wonders if they have the resources to go house to house and street to street, especially in Aleppo that's been, you know, virtually destroyed, at least in the eastern half. They are committed, I think, to at least trying to do, you know, what they can to take most of Aleppo. And therefore, they can say that they control, you know, almost all of the major cities in Syria, certainly the ones from Aleppo down through Hama, Homs, and Damascus, and, of course, on the coast with Latakia and Tartus. In that case, the Syrian regime can say that most of the population of Syria is under their control, and they can present themselves as the only alternative and therefore be in a catbird position if, when, any sort of negotiations toward a political settlement may take place.
David Lesh said he's heard it suggested that even if the war ended today, it would take a generation to rebuild the shattered Syrian economy and restore growth to pre-war levels. He said the regime of President Bashar al-Assad would need billions to rebuild, and much of the money would have to come from countries now demanding his removal from power. The so-called Trump rally in U.S. financial markets has taken a pause Monday after all markets set record levels on Friday. As investors ponder their next moves, VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York with a busy week of events that may have some impact on market moves.
Hello. Well, there is a lot on the calendar this week, including retail holiday sales, which analysts have been picking through, and it was a record. In fact, on Thanksgiving alone, sales were up 13.6%. Out of the $1.1 billion in sales, nearly half of that was done via mobile technology. So I find that to be quite interesting. And we're really seeing how brick and mortar continues to be lower in foot traffic. In fact, it was about 10% lower. Most retailers seem to be agnostic towards this. They really don't care where the revenue stream is coming in as long as they're seeing those increases in sales. And that's certainly what they're seeing. In addition, this week on November 30th, we have the OPEC meeting in Vienna. I don't expect to get much out of this since the world is already producing at record levels. So we'll look to see if there's any freeze or production terminology in the statement. And then also remains to be seen if the OPEC members actually adhere to any agreements that they come up with. And of course, we have 7 Fed speakers making the rounds this week into that December 14th interest rate hike meeting. So they're pretty clear in telegraphing their message. Right now, the markets are pricing at about a 92% chance that we will get that hike. And finally, on Friday, we have the monthly employment report. So there really is a lot for traders to contend with. But right now, it seems as if jobs and the interest rate hike are going to be in the forefront.
And traditionally, December seems to be an up month.
Yeah, it tends to be an up month. But I think right now, because it has been such a crazy year for the markets, I mean, think about it. In 2016, this certainly has been the year of change for the better that remains to be seen. We had Brexit in June, and then President-elect Trump surprisingly made it into office. So right now, it's going to continue to be on, can he fulfill his big promises that were made on the campaign trail? And although we do expect some pro-growth policies to be enacted in 2017 and help spur job gains, that's also going to include corporate tax reform, fiscal stimulus, and some of the president-elect's lofty goals. We have to see if that's going to be attainable or not. One of his promises is to create jobs, and he said a lot of jobs. You know, we expect a solid number of jobs to be created over the next 4 years, but LPL Financial did some really interesting research on this, and they found with certainty that LBJ's record of 16.5% labor force growth during the 1965 to 68 term is out of reach. So while we expect Trump to create jobs over that 200,000 mark per month to get to that 465,000 level that LBJ had, that's a record that we have not seen in quite some time.
Creating much in the way of economic news for us, our economics correspondent in New York, Jill Malandrino. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. It has been nearly 4 years since 20 children and 6 educators were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Newtown, a new documentary that looks at the effect the massacre had on the small town and the country.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, what's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's going on.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get everybody you can going down there.
It's still happening.
The film opens with the horrified voices of people calling 911 to report the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The new documentary, Newtown, uses first-person interviews with some of the victims' families, neighbors, and co-workers to tell the story. Mark Barden's son, Daniel, was one of those killed.
I still have a little secrets stashed around. He used to wear this old yellow football helmet when he'd ride in the little seat in the back of my bicycle. And I have that in the garage, and it still has some beautiful little long blonde hairs of his in it.
In one scene, Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was also shot, shows a room stacked with boxes of condolence cards, gifts, and other items from well-wishers.
This is most of the stuff that's been I don't even know how many thousands of letters and gifts and portraits. So many of them have never been opened because I just can't do that yet.
Kim Snyder, who also directed Welcome to Shelbyville about Somali refugee immigrants in small town America, is Newtown's director.
And we felt we had not seen a film like this that had really looked at the trajectory of up to 3 years. We filmed over the course of 3 years. Sadly, there's been so many since, but I think Newtown for so many people was a watershed moment and really needed to be, you know, we needed to bear witness to that so that with the hope that we can, that something could change.
Maria Cuomo Cole is the film's producer. She says that the filmmakers wanted to remain sensitive to the pain community members were in, but also wanted to highlight the bravery and endurance shown by Newtown.
Kim and I felt it was extremely important to be as sensitive as possible, of course, in telling this important story, a story that, you know, we don't have the luxury to forget in America. It's, you know, it's hard stuff. But it's part of who we are, and hopefully, you know, we can learn from it and create change to keep communities safe.
Do you promise to live life to its fullest?
I do!
Do you promise to cherish family and friends?
I do!
The film takes a hopeful turn when it shows community members taking part in the Daniel Barden Mudfest, an endurance race that benefits several charities. Nicole Hockley has also been able to go into the room of condolence gifts and to start opening some of them. The issue of gun control has been hotly debated in this year's presidential campaign. Maria Cuomo said her hope is that Newtown will touch people's hearts on both sides of the issue and will result in change. That change has still not arrived. Earlier this year, the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history took place in Orlando, with 49 people gunned down at a nightclub. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And we thank you for joining us for International Edition. For Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Dave Magnus, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States recently observed Transgender Day of Remembrance, honoring members of the transgender community killed because of their gender identity. Transgender persons around the world are targeted by rising levels of violence, fueled by hatred and bigotry, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a press statement. Special Envoy for the Human Rights of LGBTI Persons, Randy Berry, said the current situation for transgender individuals around the world is very close to his heart.
It is clear that in nearly every country, in nearly every society, the level of violence, significant violence against members of the transgender community, is far, far higher, an order of magnitude higher than it is even against other members of the LGB community, which themselves are highly stigmatized. And it's borne out when you take a look at life expectancy figures for transgender individuals, for example, even here at home, or if you look at rates of attempted suicide for transgender youth, even here at home.
Around the world, human rights and fundamental freedoms are recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which states that every person is born free and equal in dignity and rights. Every person includes transgender women, transgender men, and other individuals who face marginalization on account of their gender expression or gender identity. The United States is partnering with governments and civil society around the world to further the understanding that LGBTI rights are human rights. Understanding is key, said Special Envoy Berry.
It just shows me that in places where understanding, where visibility, where some effort is being made to basically understand the human reality of transgender individuals, we can begin to chip away at those numbers. But we have a tremendous distance still to go in terms of our national conversations on what it means to be transgender, what it means to have equal protection under the law based on the person that you were born to be.
When all persons reach their full human potential, free from fear, intimidation, and violence, wrote Secretary Kerry, nations become more just, secure, and prosperous.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.